Welcome to this next lecture on virtual machines. So I tried to introduce a next operator, a novel operator, into our Prolog language, which our implementation has to take care of, and that was the cut operator. The cut operator. So no, where is it? Here is the cut operator. And what is the cut operator? So as a motivating example, I briefly explained, but I think it's worthwhile to explain it again, was the following implementation, which is can be considered as an if-then-else construct. What is an if-then-else construct? The condition, assume that the condition on which we want to branch is P, is the predicate P. So if P holds for some X, then we want to continue with the Q1. And if P doesn't hold, we would like to continue with the Q2. Yeah? So now the question is, what does it mean for P not to hold? That's a little bit of a difficult thing, because we have no negation in Prolog. So there is no built-in negation. Why? Prolog, when we try to, the Prolog interpreter or the Prolog implementation or runtime system can do is try to prove that a predicate holds. And so it may happen that the predicate does not hold. Then this can result in several things. Either our complete proof search fails, or we encounter non-termination. And so this is if we kind of negate as only when, or we kind of assume that something does not hold, or can conclude that something does not hold only if it terminates, then this is a particular form of negation, which is called negation by failure. Yeah, so here that is the best kind of negation we can hope for in Prolog, because non-termination cannot be observed, because we cannot wait for non-termination and then do something else. So this is difficult operationally. So therefore, we have this negation by failure. So here we assume that P, whether P holds or not, can be kind of, the interpreter can decide in finite time. So that's the first assumption which we should note. And now, so that means if there is any proof of P, then please continue with Q1 and Q2. So, but now what happens if Q, then please continue with Q1. Now, but what happens now if Q1 fails? Because, so if Q1 fails, then there would be backtracking. If there were no cut operator, then again a different proof of P would be tried, and so on. And and in the end, a different proof of P would be sought for, and that is not what we want to do. Yeah, so we want to do, if once P has been proven, so in an if then else, once the condition is true, you would like to proceed with the then part and not try the else part later. Yeah, so this means at that point we want to commit the decision. Here we want to commit the decision that we have decided for the first clause, and that means whenever Q1 fails, we will not go for the Q1 later on fails. We will not go to the other branch, but consider the whole predicate branch, the whole if then else, as a failure, and therefore proceed with the backtracking point before the branch. That is this. So this cut operator has two effects. First, it freezes whatever binding we have found here in the P, so no backtracking points inside the P, but also the backtracking point at branch is kind of given up. Okay? So that it means backtracking has to return to backtrack points preceding the call to the left-hand side. So what can we do? So if we want to implement this cut operator, what we have to do is we kind of restore the old backtrack pointer from our current stack frame. So there we have the backtrack pointer which was encountered before the predicate, before our current stack frame. So in there we have this old BTBP, and that we kind of restore. And then furthermore, since this now is the current stack, the current backtrack point, there is no backtrack point anymore on top of it. And now recall that every backtrack point results in a stack frame pushed on top of the stack. And all these, in particular all those backtrack points which have been created during the proving of the P, they all can be popped. Yeah. So that means here we pop all stack frames on top of the locals. And that is good news, because in this sense the cut operator not only prunes the search space, but also shrinks the stack. Yeah. So that now how to accomplish these two tasks? So we do that by a sequence of two instructions. So one is the prune instruction. The prune instruction is meant and then followed by the by pushenvm. Pushenvm, where m is the number of local of our current local variables. This is the operation which pops the stack. So that is at that particular point we pop all the things which we would have liked to pop at the end of the intermediate at the endpoint of the intermediately reached clauses. And so that is kind of that accounts for the popping of the stack. And the pruning, this is meant, so I have introduced this instruction in order, pruning means restriction of the search space, that is the should restore the old backtrack pointer. So accordingly, so using these two instructions before I show you the implementation of prune, let us first see how the code would look like. So here we kind of assume, so here is our super, so no clause indexing here to keep things simple, and there is no meaningful clause indexing possible for that branch predicate. So that here is the try chain. We set the backtrack point, we try the alternative A, we delete the backtrack point and then jump to B. Yeah? And now that is the ordinary backtrack, the ordinary try chain. Now what happens in the implementation? So here for the first clause, we push there are two locals, therefore push env2. We mark the stack frame for the call p of x, and we call p of p with one argument, and in between we have put the argument. Okay, so that's for the first literal. Now comes the cut. The cut is translated into our fabulous sequence of prune, followed by push env2. And then comes the Q1, which is the last literal. So therefore we have a last mark. Then we put the arguments and then a last call. Now here in this particular case, we observe that we will that there is definitely no further backtrack point on top of the stack. Why? Because we had the prune, and that has removed all the backtrack points. And also we know that we will not, so this is in that sense a last call, a last clause. So therefore we can simplify that here as I have hoped to show you by directly putting the arguments, doing the move and jumping. Yeah, so that's kind of an optimization. Now let's see for the B is the start point of the second clause. The second clause is definitely a last clause, and so there is one literal in it. So we can we will not return to branch or to that thing. So therefore we can kind of here the last call, and the last call optimization means we directly first we push env, we make push env 2 because it's a two variable clause, and then we put the arguments by put ref 1, put ref 2, then we move the two arguments down into the stack frame below by this move, and then we directly jump to Q2. Directly jump to Q2. Okay? So now the new instruction prune, and as I have tried to explain to you, this is not a difficult operation, but it is rather simple. We just take the old BP and restore it into the BP. That's all. This is prune. So you see, in the operationally, what happens, what has to happen at the cut, is very simple. Still, to understand the control flow by just looking at the Prolog program might not always be so simple. There's one more problem. What happens if a cut has been placed deliberately? In a single clause. And what is the problem with a single clause? Because for efficiency reasons, we so far have not stored the old BP in the single clause. So therefore, if we translate the cut occurring inside the single inside a single clause by the prune, it would not kind of be correct. It would not be kind of meaningful because in the current stack frame there is simply no backtrack point. There is no meaningful value. But still there could be a cut in a. So let me write a tiny example. So we have P of X. Then we still could do a Q1 of X. And then write a cut, and then write a Q2 of X. And this could still be a meaningful clause in Prolog. Why? It would not help to kind of, there's no second alternative for the P. So in that sense, this does not help. For that, the cut does not help, but it helps in that sense that whatever backtrack points have been introduced by Q1, they are pruned here. So we commit to the binding of X found by the first attempt to prove Q1. Yeah, that's it. That's the effect of the cut here. And it would not kind of change something. It would not kind of change something otherwise, only that the Q1 in between might have kind of created new backtrack points, and they are sitting somehow on the stack, and they will all be thrown away. And now we have to find what was the last backtrack point before entering the P. And in order to have that at hand, we have to kind of manually store that backtrack point in the stack frame for the P. Yeah, otherwise, it would have been stored somewhere, yes, but in the stack frames, in the backtrack points inserted into the stack by the proving attempt for Q1. But all those stack frames are not looked at anymore. They are simply thrown away. So therefore, it is better, the easiest way to deal with that is to inspect that single clause for the P, notice that there is a cut, and under this particular condition, set the cut explicitly. So here is what set cut means. Set cut is not a very complicated operation. It's just kind of the inverse of the pruning. It just takes this one, this value, and puts it into the stack. Yeah, so in that sense, this setting, this set cut is, we could have introduced this operation earlier and could have called it in the translation of a clause which is potentially a backtrack point. And inside this, when we do the set BP, we might have in the set BP, we might have singled out the saving of the backtrack point, but we have not singled it out because there we had a combined instruction which also saved the trail pointer and the heap pointer. Yeah. Okay. So this means once again, so if we have this set, if we have a predicate which is implemented by a single clause, we kind of in such a predicate. Let me write again such a predicate which we had here. If we have this P of X Q of X Q1 Q2 of X, then the code for P would start with a set. So if A is the label of an if P1 is the label of the predicate P, we would kind of start with set cut, and then comes the code for the Q1, then comes the code for the cut, and then comes the code for the Q2. That's the way how we would do it. Yeah. So the try chain kind of starts with, in that case, with the setting of the cut. Yeah. So this is a kind of minimalistic try chain. And please note, when we have this, when we have multiple try chains, because we do clause indexing, then there could be individual try chains which consist of a single clause only. In that case, we would have this try chain would immediately have consisted in jumping to the corresponding alternative. Yeah, and now we do this setting of the cut and then jumping. Okay. So that kind of tries to explain what we would do. What we would do at the cut in connection with clause indexing. Now, please. Then comes the final thing. Is now the final example. Who? Ah, he's not leaving in under protest. So it's just so. Okay. So now there's a very important thing. Now we want to assume that we are given a predicate P. And we want to have the negation of it. A predicate which is true when P is false. So this is kind of an implementation of or exploitation of this negation of by failure. Yeah. So we have no negation in Prolog, but that is the best which we can kind of implement to obtain something like a negation. And it is kind of, in order to learn something about Prolog, it is instructive to look at that and to notice what kind of properties it has. By the way, when I which I have here implemented in some sense is not what you could implement that in Prolog easily, but there is Prolog provides something else. It has a not operator, and the not, so you, it's kind of a meta predicate, so you can write not P. And that's, if I'm not completely mistaken, you can write not P of X. So this is a bit weird, because then not takes, it has a, It's a predicate, meta predicate, which is where the implementation is built in, and it takes as an argument the term, and it interprets the root constructor of the term as a predicate, and so on. So it's therefore I would call it a meta predicate. Yeah, but so we do not. I will not explain here how to deal with meta predicates, but only write an implementation for P. We might implement a predicate not P, and the implementation of this predicate not P behaves like this meta predicate not, and it does the following. So not. So here I assume that P has a, for simplicity, only one argument. Yeah. So what? So here, let's see. So not P tries to prove P. If it succeeds, then it's the bang, the cut, says, okay, now I know P holds. And then I run into this fail predicate. Fail means that it will fail means that this alternative. Now let me wonder. Let me think. Fail means that the whole predicate then fails, and we do not try to reprove it again. Yes, the whole predicate then fails if P is true. On the other hand, if P cannot be proven, that means the computation fails already in here. Yeah, if P cannot be proven, then P of X will fail, and then we kind of never reach the cut. We will not never reach the cut. And then we immediately enter the not P thing, the second clause, which is kind of a catch-all. It is unconditionally true, claimed fact, and then not P will be true. So what we kind of see here is a particular interesting thing, which I might, well, it kind of. So if I write that, not PA, then if that is true, then this means that, the proving of P of A has failed, but afterwards, not P is, so then this, the second clause is tried. So that means PX, yeah. So this means that X will be bound to A, and then it is, yeah. So that works. And now perhaps one more thing: if we kind of do. So what I want to say is that in this not P will not bound this predicate not P X not P will never bind an additional variable. Yeah, so if the term arrives in the term for which not P is called contains variables, these are not bound. Why? Because if the proving fails of P of X, P of this term T containing the here A of X, if the proving fails, then all the bindings encountered during that proof will kind of be unbound again, and then the next alternative is tried, and that is unconditionally true, and in the right on the right hand side, no further bindings are encountered. So therefore, no variables are bound beyond those which have already been bound before at the call. Okay. So that's this now, this is this negation of failure. Once again, if P can be proven, then this predicate will fail. And if P cannot be proven, then it will succeed. So now let's see how we can kind of implement that. So we see it's a two-clause predicate. So we have to install clause indexing. Doesn't make sense here because there is no inspection of the first argument. And so we kind of, without clause indexing, we kind of can build up our try chain. So we set a backtrack point. We try the first alternative. We delete the backtrack point and jump to the second. So for the first, it is, as we have seen multiple times now, for these, in these simple cases, this is a one predicate, variable clause, and therefore we push. We make push env one and then create the code for the first literal. That is, we mark a stack frame. We make put ref one to create the argument and we call the predicate. That's it. And now comes the implementation of the cut. Here again in red, the implementation of the cut. So that is here. And then comes the implementation of the fail literal. But the fail literal, okay, so that is just fail. Yeah, that's instruction fail. And then afterwards we pop the environment. Clearly this popping of the environment is, could mark it in black, is never reached, so therefore it could also be removed. Yeah, because after the fail, you will not return to that literal. You kind of, yeah. Okay, because fail calls backtracking. But on the other hand, this is not harmful. It's simply never reached. Now comes the implementation of the second clause. The second clause is even simpler. One variable, therefore push env one, and then an empty body, and therefore just the pop env. Okay. So that's it. And so now we are done with Prolog. In Prolog there are more things. As I said, these meta predicates. There is this implementation, and there is a kind of a rudimentary arithmetic thing, which is a little bit of on the weird side, because it provides kind of an is predicate. So you can write something like x is y plus 3. And this is kind of a strange thing. I guess it expects y not to be a free variable, but whenever that broken point is reached, y must be bound to a number. And then you have this, and then this plus is in, this is predicate forces the expression on the right hand side to be not considered as a term, but considered as a something which must be evaluated. So is triggers the evaluation of the term, and that means that the number for the y will be added to 3, and the resulting number is bound to x. I'm not completely sure whether x must be unbound before, or whether it could be bound and it will fail if it is different from the result. So I'm not completely sure. You may make a little bit of an experiment whether x could be bound to such a constant or whether that is ruled out. But yeah. So that is this strange is predicate, and by that you can do, because without being able to calculate with numbers, programming languages typically are a little bit on the weak side, and there's also some kind of reading from files and writing to files. I'm not so sure whether you can do whether there is direct support for graphics. I guess not. So you have to provide external means to do the graphical interaction with your Prolog program. Okay, so but that's essentially what you have there, and at least in as perhaps Stefan has told you, in some areas of artificial intelligence and when for automatic when automatic reasoning is important, then people like this language at least. Are there questions? If not, then I may kind of fill. So then I can tell you about the further plans of this lecture. So the first step would be that we kind of fill a kind of a little gap in our presentation so far, and that is we assumed both for the functional for the machine for functional languages and for that Prolog machine, we kind of assumed that there is a heap data structure it allows us to allocate new heap elements and containing references to other heap elements, and we kind of manipulated the heap through the stack. So on the stack we had references to that heap data structure. And I may explicitly or implicitly assumed that there is some kind of memory management which by now and then looks at the heap elements which have in the heap and checks which of them are still required and which of them are garbage and will kind of remove them. But that is kind of something which we might happily assume, but the question is how is that implemented? And it is worthwhile to inspect the conditions under which garbage collection has to be performed, and note a significant difference. And the significant difference is that the VIM, the machine for Prolog, has already some kind of heap deallocation. And that was when there is backtracking. For backtracking, we kind of popped the heap. We popped everything which was allocated since the last backtrack point. And that was kind of by that, because these kind of heap elements have been introduced in order to build terms and bindings encountered since then, and all those bindings are kind of undone, and so they can safely be removed. So this means there is some garbage, some heap deallocation, but this is not sufficient, because even if there is no failure, so think of you make this appending, this appending of lists, then there is, you can kind of deterministic, this is was more or less a deterministic program, at least if you use the predicate in the appropriate way. And the cute Prolog programmer will essentially write deterministic programs. And so, like a cute functional programmer will essentially write tail recursive functions, so a cute Prolog programmer will write essentially deterministic programs, and only in very rare places will use this backtracking. So this means, to put it to the extreme, you could write then a Prolog program which does no backtracking at all, but still it allocates terms on the heap, which then are kind of, which might become garbage nonetheless. And then that kind of garbage then is not taken care of by this garbage, this automatic heap deallocation at failed alternatives. So that means we need an additional garbage collection also for the VIM. So there is the world of garbage collection is an issue of its own. So there are all kinds of, there have been various suggestions for garbage collection, and which are more or less efficient, and it happens even that the success or failure of a programming language may depend also on the garbage collector, because I think the success of OCaml comes from its extremely efficient garbage collection. So therefore, a programmer doesn't even notice if the space consumption is not exceedingly high, whether there is a garbage collector around. If you compare that with Java, I guess in Java they consider that a not so important issue, I would think. I'm not so sure, but I think they have also improved the garbage collector in the last revision of the Java Virtual Machine, because there object-oriented programming in the style of Java is mainly imperative, and there you mainly go for so data structures are not so dynamic in many applications, and therefore the brute force mechanism is to use a huge heap and let it fill up and hope that the program terminates before ever garbage collection is encountered. I guess this is the way how typical Java programs behave. And when Java programs start to do collection, then you have already used a huge amount of space, and then you are likely to have an inefficient program anyway. So, but here for functional languages and as well as for Prolog, it is crucial to have it. And here we will not kind of discuss the most refined garbage collectors, but kind of the mere principles. Who of you ever has kind of learned anything about garbage collection? So what did you learn? So where, in which lecture? So you yourself kind of looked at the problem. Sorry? You yourself kind of explored the problem. So what did you do there? You read a book? Aha. Okay. So let's see then what one would kind of, what is the issue with garbage collection. So the first issue is, you kind of have to detect that what is garbage. You have to distinguish between garbage and non-garbage. And then you have to kind of remove the garbage and kind of collect so that only the non-garbage cells are remain. So one possibility to do that is to use a stop and copy collector. And a stop and copy collector works in that way that it not only kind of reclaims the free memory, but also compacts the memory. And that is, if you compact, you have to move heap elements around. And so you could also kind of copy them, so you have to copy them anyway, so you could copy them to a fresh slice of memory. And so therefore most of them conceptually at least separate the heap into two parts, the to space and the from space. And so in the to space there are the current heap objects, and then you copy the life objects into the to space, and then you flip, and then the to space becomes the current space. Yeah? So yeah. So that is what happens. So in the current, in the from space, typically you kind of, there you allocate the new things, and at some when the memory is exhausted, you call the collector, which kind of copies the live objects into the to space. Now, how can the, is the how what kind of how can at least conceptually such a collector work? So the first thing is the it should kind of detect what are which objects are live and which are dead, because you want to remove the dead ones, or you want to know what kind of objects you have to move to the to space. And so that is, you have to mark all reachable objects. And then you copy all the marked objects into the to space. And now if you, that's kind of a problem, these objects contain references. If you just literally copy such an object into the to space, they still point into the from space. So therefore, at some point, you have to do a correction of references. Or, you have to do a correction of references, and then you exchange these two. And these three operations, so that I may kind of state right in the right way, need not necessarily be separated in four phases. So you could kind of, this marking and copying, you could do perhaps even at the same time. At the same time, you, as you mark something, you could also put it directly into the to space. And now, in order to also, as soon as you, what would you do for the with the references? So that's the problem. If you move something into the to space, the references are still to the from space. So what you can do is you can leave in the from space kind of a dummy, which is holds a forward reference to the copied object, so that later when you go through the to space, you see the references to the dummy. In the dummy has been denoted where this object has moved, and then you can correct. And you can improve on that correction of the references also, that when you copy right away, you kind of check whether all the objects you reference have already been moved. And if so, you kind of directly correct the references. Then you might perhaps visit much less, then you might have much less corrections to be performed. There's another issue which you may have noticed, so that this is an algorithm which runs for the garbage collection, and these algorithms might be implemented in a recursive way, if it is not a recursive way, it needs kind of, since it's graph traversal in some sense, DFS or BFS or whatever. So therefore, you need kind of a stack or a queue or something to maintain not yet finished nodes. And that is, you need extra space, extra organizational space for realizing the stack, the runtime stack of the garbage collector. There's one way out, and there's an interesting thing like pointer rotation, where you kind of implement that stack within the objects which you have visited, but that is kind of a subtle algorithm which I will not explain to you. But that's kind of the questions what people think worry about. This is a crucial routine which runs all the time and which strongly influences the overall runtime and efficiency of your programming language, and therefore people have invested all kinds of bit nibbling and efficiency in order to tune these to make these algorithms as fast as possible. So now, once again, so let us now. So that was kind of I tried to give you kind of some ideas what people could do to improve these algorithms, but for the moment, let us just see how the individual faces, what kind of, what we have to do there. So as a kind of a specification of the problem. So the first thing, as I said, one has to detect the live objects. Now the question is, that is, in essence, this is graph reachability. You check what is reachable. Why? Because if you have an object which is live, so which might still be used by the program, and if this object contains references, then everything which is referenced may also be accessed by the program, and therefore should also be considered as live. Yeah. So this and that kind of issue, I think maybe I explained that at some point to you, that one might improve or might help the garbage collector to override objects which the programmer knows by deeper insight or what reasons ever as being dead by overwriting the reference to these objects with null. I guess Java programmers, careful Java programmers will do that. You could do that also for improving functional programs or even Prolog programs. Yeah, but then there's still even so that so we have so that so therefore detection of live objects amounts to graph reachability. A major issue is that is however is where to start. What are the reachable from what? What is your opinion? Which kind of, what are the start points for the graph traversal? Where do we start? I mean, graph, what does it mean, reachable? So I need some naturally live objects, which are... Some global objects. So, do we have in functional programming any global objects? No.
I thought about C now. About the C-like.
If you have a C-like language, but even that is not sufficient. So, global things would be nice, yes. So, what is stored in a global variable or also in Java? If you have something, if you have a global static something, yeah, that is, these are, this is a subset of the life, of the roots, so to speak. For the reachability, but what else? Suggestions, please.
From the current state, right? Everything that is reachable from the current execution point.
Yes, so everything what is in the stack, so you're right. So,
locals and globals from the current.
So, in this, whatever references are contained in the stack, there is no global variables. So in functional programming, but everything what is reachable from the stack might is live. So if you think of Java, there are these global variables, yes. So that these static variables. So these also would be considered as live and could be contain further references. In Java, you have more. What do you have besides? Which cannot, which should be roots for the collector. So you have, there must be something to kind of lift the, or answer the question myself. So there is something like threads. And so even if the thread object is not referenced at all, you cannot collect the object of a thread as long as the thread is running. You can only collect it when the thread is dead. So there must be something in the virtual machine like a thread table, which contains all currently live threads. And these would be then also sources for the garbage collector. Because recall, for these you run the you call the method run, and then, former or later, this thread will run, and so you cannot collect it. even if there is no reference from the main to that. So that is, so in that sense, thread objects are also roots. What else? Is there more in that style in Java? Well, now I'm terribly disappointed. So there's what you see on the screen. So there are window objects, frames. So a frame, if it is set invisible and is not not referenced otherwise, it and it's not has no visible containers, then it you can collect it. But otherwise, it you cannot collect it. So if you see it on the screen, you cannot collect it, because then it suddenly would disappear. This would be a bad effect, which we would like to avoid. So therefore, there must be something in the Java runtime which keeps track of the visible parts of the of the visible components on the screen, and these cannot be collected. Once again, they need not be part of a thread. There should need not be a thread. There's just a window, and it's visible. And you click at something, and then a method is called. There's no thread for it. Well, there might be a thread, but that is not a thread maintained by the programmer and started by the programmer. So this is this event-based. It's kind of an event-based computation. So there is a... So there is something by the framework. So it could be that there is kind of some kind of event handler thread which is there in the background, and that could, and that holds a reference to the window. Could be. But these are kind of, yeah, if this is the case, then the maintaining references to live threads would be sufficient. But
there's also a possibility to get a window without an associated thread, some language.
Well, not in Java, because you have always these things that... you can create events by mouse events. So if you go with mouse inside a window, then this is noticed, and you could kind of install a handler for it, even if there is no button and nothing. And you have this. You can resize a frame, and you can close it. And so there are a lot of things which are attached to frames, even if there is no particular thing which the user has. Done there.
Is it even more from the operating system, like file handles and sockets and everything like that?
That's a good question. It could be. So if there is such things, then... So what I wanted to say by that, by asking these questions, is that there are some obvious things, like the stack or the globals, which should be live, but there are some hidden things also, which must be carefully... taking care of threads is one thing. I'm not sure whether a Java program has automatically something for a file. So, but whenever there's something like something triggers events, and some then there is some kind of machinery to react to the when there is some machinery to react to these events. So if there is a kind of an event, there is an event queue, and things can be entered, and there is kind of an event handler. But I guess there's only one instance of that, and there's no separate instance for this and for that. At least, I think you can yourself create another one, perhaps, but usually you have a one event queue. Taken with... So that's my experience by experiments with Java. But one might look up, so that's kind of, I just wanted by that discussion open up a little bit of an awareness of things which should be taken into account. And so there are a lot of things which, there are several things which should be taken into account. Yeah. Okay? So in that sense, the Java is in that sense quite a complicated beast, and many things have to be taken care of. So let's see now in how this marking would go. Just for this little example, so we start perhaps assuming that this here is our is a root. So this reference comes from the stack, and then we would find A, this object labeled A, and this object contains two references. And by the way, in that sense, the low-level implementation must provide tags so that you can distinguish a number from a reference. Because on the low level, you have bits, and then you must know, this is this sequence of bits a pointer, or is it a number? And the garbage collector, because the garbage collector is unaware of your, not so aware of your implementation, and the layout of your object. So it's somehow either from the layout of the objects or from each reference itself, it must decide whether something is a number or a reference. So in that sense here, if we think of that objects consist of a tag and a sequence of references, then this is easy. But if you have a mixture of numbers and references, then you kind of need a particular way, depending on the label A, a particular method to collect that particular struct. And that is kind of something which the Haskell people do. They have kind of every object knows how it should be collected. So, okay, so now seeing that, so we find that that and these kind of two things must be collected. And that means we follow that thing here. We come here and find that is also to be collected. We follow that and we find, okay, that also must be collected. So we have found these three objects are, and then we kind of follow that and we see, okay, that has already been collected and we need not collect it anymore. And then, since this has not been marked, it is garbage. Now, you see, one more thing. If you kind of, so what we could do now is, if we do the copying, we just follow. That is a big advantage. We just follow the references and the objects which we have marked as reachable and copy them. And that means we would never, this has the big advantage, that the garbage need not be visited at all. So if you have after some time perhaps 10% live objects and the rest is garbage, the garbage collector will only use time proportional to the 10% and not the 90% which is garbage. So that's a good property of this copying collector. Yeah. So that would mean, so we first copy the object, and now, as I kind of indicated, as the references go to, if we literally copy the an element to the two space, then the references go in the wrong direction. So therefore, we kind of leave something like a forward reference there. So that is, if we do that, then we kind of copy the A and leave a reference to A on at that position where it was. And then we kind of copy the C and leave a forward reference to it, and then we kind of copy the D and also a forward reference, and then we can kind of traverse the two space and kind of correct all the addresses. So Okay. And then we kind of set the exchange the roles, and that means the we also have to correct the, and that's also important, we not only have to correct the heap, but also all sources like the stack and all and the thread table and things like that, because the thread objects have moved, so therefore we have to kind of correct in the thread table the reference to the threads. And that we exchanging the to space to the with the from space, then we'll kind of put the program into a situation where it can run again. Okay, and here is what I kind of tried already right in the beginning. This copying, marking, copying, and placing a forward reference can all be squeezed into a single phase. This even this from the second phase, this copy, if you even this second phase of copying, of correcting the references, can be partly at least squeezed into this first phase. Yeah, and that is that I kind of tried to summarize in this sentence. So if we kind of do the traversal in such a way, in the same depth DFS-like fashion, but we make not a pre-order copying, but a post-order copying. So that is, we first copy all those, only after we have copied all the successors, we copy the current node. If we do that, then most of the objects have already been moved when we copy an object, and therefore only those references must be patched later, which are kind of back edges in the DFS run. That is, they point to predecessors of the current node. Yeah, and all together, that's a crucial and important issue. The runtime is proportional to the number of live objects, and not proportional to the garbage. This garbage collector, this is kind of the, in some sense, the way how you would deal it with in functional languages, and I guess also essentially in Java, there are two kind of two things, two issues. I may write them issues. The first thing is there could be concurrency. What do you do concurrency? Because you have this copying kind of, so you have multiple threads, allocating objects in a distributed way, in a distributed fashion. So what would one do there? So that is one thing. And in Java, for example, so you have there two problems. First, you have, if you have just a single memory provider, chunk provider, then you kind of sequentialize the allocation, and then if you the memory is exhausted, you would have to run a single you have to stop the all threads and start in order to start the collector. If or there's another thing that you kind of try to do collections in parallel, so you stop only some threads, or you stop no threads and just do the collection concurrently. So that would be the dream, and that is a difficult thing. And so there is, this is still, it's not, so there one can come have innovative ideas to marry garbage collection with concurrency. So this is one issue. And the other issue is it really, so if you have 1 gigabyte of main memory to collect, 1 gigabyte of heap space to collect, then this can take some time. And usually you wouldn't, it is better for the application if you have several short things instead of one big thing, because that means for some point, for 10 minutes, your system doesn't do anything because all the memory is reclaimed. So what can one do there? So for that, collectors usually or often do not kind of have just one from space and one to space, but kind of separate the space, the heap, into generations. And a generation is, so there is, for example, a generation of young objects and a generation of old objects. And young, so the theme is young nodes die young. So there is a huge amount of objects which are very short time, with very short lifetime. And these should not accumulate, but should be collected immediately. And once, if an object has survived for a certain amount of time, it is likely to live even longer. So this means that if you collect only the young nodes, you will kind of get most of the garbage done, and the others you have not even to look at. And that kind of gives you a much faster garbage collection. And these, therefore, the standard in, say, in OCaml is to use such a generational collector. And the generational collectors could be either use two generations only, or use n generations, and then kind of decide how many generations are collected. I guess the OCaml uses just 2 generations. Okay, so that's this kind of inside story, which you should consider as kind of an appetizer. That there is some interesting things going on with this garbage collection, and kind of suggest you to pay attention to garbage collection for your favorite language. So there's another issue, and that is that the garbage collection somehow must harmonize with the operational behavior of the language. And that is for threads, this is true. And it is also true for the Vim. And in particular, it must harmonize with the backtracking of the Vim. Because when we do a collection, we might change the order in which of the objects in the to space and in the from space. If you look at that little example, you see A now is at the bottom, and C is on top of that, and D is even on top of that. So this is kind of a little bit. This was in this particular example. Yeah, but one might think of that. It is not clear whether always the collector which I have shown you doesn't care about the ordering of objects, because that is usually not important. But for the Vim it is important. Why? Because we need the elements of the objects on the heap to be in this to space in the same order as in the from space, because at some point we want to pop the stack. And when we pop, that means really that we rely on the order. Or an alternative thing would be that we do not pop this, we kind of give up this popping of the stack at backtracking. Then we could use the original garbage collector, but would produce huge amounts of garbage whenever we do backtracking. So this would be the alternative, that we do not, that we do this trailing, but do not do the popping of the stack. So that is here. Let us see again. So what we want to do. So here in the Vim, we need kind of a, we can do the marking in the same way as before, but then the copying we should kind of do in such a way that the ordering is preserved. And that we could achieve because now the elements in the heap are marked. We could now traverse simply the two space. The big disadvantage is that this kind of now and do the copying appropriately, but that kind of means that we the garbage collection time now depends not only on the number of live objects, but we have also to inspect the garbage. Yeah. So the summarizing, so the marking may still only visit live objects, but copying requires a separate traversal of through the from space, and therefore copying now is expensive. Okay, so that kind of was a final remark and add on to the implementation of the functional of functional languages and Prolog. And so in the rest of the lecture, I then now would return to more traditional things, namely, or more conventional things, if you like, with which you are might be more familiar, namely to, we would now again, we would try to see how to implement, what we have to do in order to implement classes and objects. That's one thing. And the other thing is, what do we have to do to implement threads? So these are the two remaining themes which we now want to look at. Okay? So is there any question about that? Now for classes and objects, now the question is, how, what kind of language should we choose? So I have shown you C, and now we could go to Java, but that's a little bit boring because you all know Java very well, and there is no pointers, and so the C machine is not appropriate. So we would kind of have to remove the pointers from the C machine, introduce something like a heap, and do the allocation of objects there. But we could also take another road, and that would be just extend C in the way they have done it by going from C to C++. As you all know, C++ is not a superset of C anymore, because there are two standardization committees, and they have made distinct design decisions, and so it's modern C is no longer a subset of modern C++, which is a bit weird, but I think the details are minor. So here for us it's just we go to an extension, and it's not really C++ in full, but kind of a mild simplification. Because yeah, C++ is a monster. I would not dare to explain it in 2 weeks in total. Who is a, by the way, who is an expert C++ programmer?
Nobody is an expert C++ programmer.
Who believes that he's a reasonably well C++ programmer? So two. So that's not so bad fraction, because I think here in the in our department several people, several groups complain about the low knowledge of students, and not only of students, but only also of researchers, of their research assistants in C++, and would like to boost C++ knowledge more heavily. So I think these graphics people, everything there seems to be in C++ also. I guess Alphonse Kemper and Thomas Neumann would be happy if they were equipped with C++ programmers, and NAVAP, these people, and I guess also these. So actually, everybody who cares about implementation wants to have C++. implementers or students knowing that, but there's these kind of programmers seem to be a rare species. So, by the way, there is some language which people call, which calls itself D. You know of that? So this, in some sense, this what we do here is more in the spirit of D. So D is kind of a simplified version of C++, but in the end providing virtually this almost the same expressiveness, but cutting away all these ugly features. But it seems not still not so popular. Anyway, so let's see what we kind of can do. Maybe I hope I kind of explain it right. So here is now kind of, so we have C, and now we kind of introduce classes and objects. So here is an implementation of such a class. So in some sense, a class can be considered as more or less the same as an extension of the concept of a struct. And that means that it is a type, and you provide fields like here, and you kind of have a, so here is a list constructor, and then you have something that is the difference between C++, perhaps one major difference between C++ and Java, that in by default you have no method overwriting. So the default is you use the method which is there. If you call it, it will be the static method. And only if you kind of explicitly mark a method as virtual, only then you are allowed to overwrite it. So here in that case, this last method is something which could be overwritten. So, and what can you do here? So it's like, as you might expect in a language like Java, you can access to the, in such a method, you might access the components of the fields of the class and check them and return them and make things like that. And but here's there's one more thing, but that is perhaps now kind of different from what we I should kind of try. Yeah, so now I have the right marking. So here you see one more interesting thing, and that is objects do not necessarily live in the heap. They could also live in the stack. And therefore if you have something, so you might have pointers to lists, so that is what kind of in Java, so in Java you only, in some sense, only have pointers to objects. So here, and therefore if next is a reference to, or is a pointer to something, then you might dereference that pointer, then you are at the object, which is the real, the data, the struct containing the data and the method, and then you can call that method from there. So that's the point. You have a, in some sense, boxed and unboxed, explicitly directly the naked object, so to speak. So that is, and that's the thing which we kind of study here. So many other issues from C++ we will kind of not really consider. For example, we will not only very briefly sketch multiple inheritance related issues. There is, I think, Michael Petter in his programming languages lecture, he explains this various approaches to multiple inheritance in great detail. So here we kind of do not touch that very much. Okay. So, but we, when I say we adopt the C++ perspective on classes of object, then I mean this, that an object can be boxed or unboxed. It can live on the stack or in the heap. And that we, so we extend our implementation of C, and that means that classes are considered something like an extension of the concept of structs. They have attributes, and then additionally, that's kind of a new thing. They have things like they have constructors, and actually in C++ they are very careful also to provide destructors. So in some sense, we have no. I do not provide any specific thing for destructors. Here, but we could kind of easily add destructors. So what are destructors meant for, to be meant for?
Well, for example, if you have an object that contains some attributes where it allocates some space, then when the object gets destroyed, you want also to deallocate that space.
So you, when is the deallocator called? That's the main question. When the object is going out of scope, the destructor is called automatically. And that makes it and I guess conceptually it is meant that programmers should write destructors in such a way that the memory is cleaned up automatically as soon as things are popped or no longer necessary. But that's only partly true. That would be the case if, so that means, so it is definitely true if you have objects on the stack, because then you know when they go out of scope, that is, whenever you pop the stack, then the destructors for all the objects in the stack must be called. Yes. So because how can you, if the object lives in the heap, how can you know that it is no longer, so it's all under control of the programmer, so the programmer can signal by doing a free, and then the destructor might be called. Yeah. And so if that works properly, then the calling of the destructors might kind of remove all the useless objects as soon as they become useless, but it means it requires very careful thinking of the programmer to do that right, and I guess that's not so easy. So there are some things like I guess you have these smart pointers or something, so where the implementation provides already some useful things like reference counters, so that the implementation itself kind of realizes that the pointer itself kind of realizes, oh, now that was the last pointer to an object, and then the object can be freed, and the destructor called, things like that. So there is help, but you must. It's a little bit brittle. Okay, so that's so here we will not, we could, but so far we have not considered the destructors. So then there is this thing with the member functions, which are virtual, and that means they are called depending on the runtime type, or non-virtual, and then they are called according to the static type of an object. And and then there are these static member functions, which are like ordinary functions. And clearly, there's also things like visibility, and there are also these keywords: public, protected, or private. And there is inheritance. And then one, this public, protected, private is these. Restriction, these keywords are targeted to the programmer. so that the one program is considered as safe and the other one is not considered as safe, and otherwise it has no operational meaning. So it's only a restriction to the programmer and not to the compiler. So in that sense, we kind of safely can ignore these keywords for the implementation, and that makes the code a little bit nicer to look at. Otherwise, we would have to throw in these keywords. It is interesting that the keyword protected means something else in Java and in C++. This is also all these kind of confusing and obfuscating things which make life not of the programmer using, perhaps experimenting with multiple languages, not easier if the same thing, if different things are this called with the same name.
What is the difference?
So protected means that the scope is restricted to things below and package. And there's nothing like that in package, like package here.
So, no package stuff.
So in C++, it's very. So it's clear. It's simply everything which is subclasses. Yeah. And subclasses and package, this is in Java. If you write nothing, then you have this restriction to package in Java. That's also kind of a restriction. Yeah. Public everywhere, nothing, this is package. Protected is package and subclass, and private is only in the class. Yeah. Okay. So let us start with something like the most simple thing, and that is the layout of objects. And clearly, we would kind of think of that we store attributes and virtual member functions inside the class, so that could be a design decision. So that is now here. It's not completely what they do in the real C++. I think there they only store the attributes, and all the static functions need not be stored at all, because they are these kind of these calls are resolved at compile time, and then they have these virtual function tables. So this is one table collecting all the virtual functions. So we could do it, this we could do, but here we kind of put them into the struct as an extra argument, as an extra field. So the non-virtual and the static member functions, they can be resolved at compile time, so they need not show up. And then the idea is that if we have a subclass, then further virtual functions, further attributes might be added, and that means we can extend the struct by adding more components. So here is more info, for example, in this my class subclass of list. And so you see here the way how one writes it with this colon, where one explicitly names the superclass. And here I guess you could kind of make a comma list and then make yourself a subclass of several ones. Okay. I guess we kind of... So for today, I think the time is over. we kind of continue next time, next time, which is tomorrow, with how we, what kind of impact it has to have these more kinds of things like virtual, non-virtual, local, global field of an object or ordinary variable, and how we have to maintain that in our address environment. But for today, thank you for your attention, and we meet again tomorrow.